Democratic and Republican parties' actions are disenfranchising Alaskan voters, and they're frankly limiting the votes of those who ask for assistance with the process.
State election laws may head to the Alaska Supreme Court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 27th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, release of Fairbanks Borough records brings more scrutiny for candidate Joe Miller.
His email account essentially had been deleted in entirety.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
An Anchorage judge today sided with both the Alaska Democratic Party and the Republican Party of Alaska against the State Division of Elections. At issue is the public display of a list of write-in candidates for this year's election. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, even as the courts issue a temporary restraining order against the practice, that decision is facing a new challenge.
State Superior Court Judge Frank Fifner issued his ruling this morning. Fifner said providing information on write-in candidates and keeping a list of those candidates at polling places is against election regulations. The Alaska Democratic Party filed suit earlier this week against the Division of Elections and its director, Gail Fanumiai, asking the courts to grant an injunction against the practice. Fifner's decision has enjoined the Division of Elections from allowing polling place workers to provide a list of write-in candidates' names to voters or to provide the names verbally, citing state election laws specifically prohibit information regarding a write-in candidate to be discussed, exhibited, or provided at the polling place. Alaska Democratic Party Chair Patty Higgins.
I feel like we were vindicated. Really glad that the judge saw fit to rule on our side. On the side of the voters.
Judge Fifner's decision could be harmful to write-in candidate Lisa Murkowski. The Alaska Democratic Party had written to the Division of Elections last week demanding the division, quote, immediately cease illegally abetting Murkowski's write-in candidacy, unquote, by allowing the write-in candidate lists at polling places. At least two incidents at early voting polling places in Chugiak and in Homer pushed the Democrats to file suit against the state on Monday. The Republican Party of Alaska joined the Democrats in the suit, charging that the change in election practices standards threatens the integrity of this year's election, while the Murkowski campaign joined the suit on the side of the state. Now there's a new twist in the case, as attorneys for the state and the Murkowski campaign have decided to challenge the Superior Court decision before the Alaska Supreme Court, saying that the write-in candidate lists were part of a broad mandate to provide voter assistance at polling places. Today, the Murkowski campaign joined the state in petitioning the Supreme Court for a stay of the Superior Court decision against the write-in lists. Steve Wachowski is spokesman for the Murkowski campaign.
The campaign believes that the Democratic and Republican parties' actions are disenfranchising Alaskan voters, and they're frankly limiting the votes of those who ask for assistance with the process. We're a state that has many non-native English speakers here, not just our Alaskan native community that may be, you know, Yupik speakers as her first language, or, Filipinos who speak Tagalog. We have a big Hispanic community here.
Wachowski says the legal action is about voter intent, and Alaskans who want to vote for a write-in shouldn't be deterred from doing so. The campaign is petitioning the state Supreme Court for immediate action in this case. Developments in the issue are still unfolding. Earlier this afternoon, the Alaska Democratic Party's attorney, Tom Daniel, offered a settlement to the Division of Elections in what Higgins is calling, quote, best interests of Alaskans in this election, unquote.
We would like the division to stop using the write-in sheet immediately, which is a violation of the law. We would like them to pay our reasonable attorney fees and costs, and we will agree that the ballots that have already been cast, including the Homer ballots, would be counted normally.
Higgins refers to the 17 ballots cast in a Homer early voting booth last week, which were cast with a write-in candidate list displayed in the booth. Democratic Attorney Daniel sent the settlement offer in an email to State Attorney Margaret Patton Walsh. No word at Newstime if the state will accept the offer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The court case involving polling place violations is just one of the legal actions marring this year's general election. Yesterday's release of U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller's personnel records by the Fairbanks North Star Bureau came after a Freedom of Information suit was filed against the bureau by several news organizations. Miller had worked part-time for the bureau as an attorney and was disciplined by his employer for having used bureau computers for political purposes, violating the bureau's ethics policy. Miller has fought the release of the records since midsummer, but recently admitted in public that he had been put on leave and docked pay. Renee Broker is the Fairbanks North Star Bureau's attorney.
This is not the result that any of us wanted. You know, read it all about in the paper. It's very sad. It is just sad.
Broker, who was Miller's boss, said he worked for the bureau for 7 years and was considered a friend and a colleague. The personnel records depict Miller's behavior when confronted about his actions by co-worker Sue Dolan. Miller had used 3 bureau computers to vote in a poll, then attempted to wipe out evidence of that use by clearing the computer's internet histories. That actually led to the discovery of his acts, as Dolan asked why the histories had been cleared on 3 computers. One memo from Broker dated March 26, 2008, notifies Miller of an investigation and possible disciplinary action for being, quote, dishonest about your conduct and about the reasons for your conduct. Other records contain emails pertinent to bureau affairs. Broker worries about email correspondence regarding TAPS litigation. When Miller finally resigned from his employment with the bureau, he wiped out his bureau emails, some pertaining to the litigation, which Broker considers public record.
What we had discovered is that his email account essentially had been deleted in entirety. That was primarily my concern because, of course, we're in ongoing litigation, and as explained in my emails, you know, we have discovery obligations to be able to provide, you know, relevant emails.
Broker says she's still trying to find out why Miller did that.
We've sent 2 different letters to Mr. Miller, but through his attorneys, basically asking for an explanation, you know, his side of the story about what happened here. We're trying to understand what happened, you know, before we draw any conclusions.
Broker said most of the missing emails were later recovered. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rash of vandalism targets Anchorage autos.
Those windows are very expensive due to their design, the fact that they have to be custom made for each vehicle.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sean Parnell and Ethan Berkowitz want to be your next governor. Do you know who you'll vote for? Hear what the candidates have to say on Debate for the State 2010. On Thursday, October 28th at 8 p.m., Alaska Public Broadcasting brings you a live debate with candidates for Alaska governor. You can submit questions now. Email to questions@debateforthestate.org. Then watch or listen to your local public television or radio station, October 28th at 8 p.m.
Anchorage police are looking for those responsible for a weekend vandalism spree that spread across the city and caused about $250,000 in damage. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Lieutenant Dave Parker of the Anchorage Police Department says a great many Anchorage car and truck owners were very startled when they went to use their vehicles last weekend.
Sometime between Friday night at 10 o'clock and Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, we had a rash of windows that were broken. There were a few in businesses, but mainly they were vehicle windows. At last count, it was more than 125.
Parker's original press release on Sunday afternoon described 60 reports. But that was just the beginning, as Lieutenant Parker's latest 125-plus tally indicates. By Tuesday morning, he suspected most of the victims had discovered they'd been hit and contacted APD. Parker says the amount of glass shattering is without precedent for the department.
We've had a few windows smashed, you know, like down one road or something like that in my history here at APD. 10, maybe 15, but never 125. At least in the last 15 or 20 years, no one here recollects there being that many windows that have been damaged.
And the geographic range stretches across the city, including the Jewel Lake and Sand Lake areas, downtown, midtown, East Anchorage, Muldoon, and Eagle River. The weapon used appears to have been a BB or pellet gun. The favorite targets of choice were the side and rear windows of SUVs.
Those windows are very expensive due to their design, the fact that they have to be custom made for each vehicle. Plus, some of those rear windows have things like windshield wipers in them. They have the windshield washer nozzle. They have the heating elements in them. And then they have the stoplight actually attached to them. So it makes it a very expensive proposition, up to $2,000 per window to replace.
In most cases, the cost of the individual windows move each vandalism incident from misdemeanor status to felony. The law defines felonies as crimes involving a value of $500 and above. One incident involving a business rises well above the highest, over $100,000 felony level.
For some reason, Allen and Peterson's was hit hard, $190,000 worth of glass breakage there.
So far, the status of the investigation into the vandalism spree remains under wraps.
Detectives are not releasing any information on information that they're receiving at this time, but again, we really need folks to come forward and to help us solve this crime because it's a huge crime wave. If someone walked into a bank and stole $250,000, that would be a significant thing. Well, these folks have created at least that much damage in just a short period of hours.
Individuals who have any information about the criminal or criminals responsible for the vandalism or simply about one of the incidents are asked to call either Crime Stoppers 561-STOP, that's 561-7867, or you may call 786-8900. The 786-8900 number should also be used if you've just discovered you too have a vehicle whose windows were broken. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
There is yet another program afoot for sustainability labeling of seafood. This one concentrates on farmed fish. It's a sustainability index that its creators hope will come into increasing use by marketers and consumers. It's called the GAPI, which stands for Global Aquaculture Performance Index. There are sustainability scores for the aquaculture programs in most countries that raise fish in ocean pens. It was created for the Lenfest Foundation by Dr. John Volpe for the University of Victoria, Canada. The index looks at factors like the amount of energy used in production, the burden on the environment outside of the pens, and the amount of drugs used on the fish. Fish farming is growing fast and has been vehemently opposed by Alaska fishermen who saw farmed fish devastate the salmon market, forcing big price reductions and big changes in the marketing and handling of wild salmon. But the new sustainability index shows that concerns about farmed salmon may be dwarfed by other sectors of the industry that are quickly expanding in many parts of the world. The index is based on 2007, the most recent year for which data is available. It rates how sustainable the fish farming program is for each species in each country, and also what the cumulative impact is. Because the salmon program has been around for decades now, many of its problems have been solved, Volpe says, and salmon-raising countries scaled up their program some time ago.
So in countries like Chile and Norway, both very high production and dominated by Atlantic salmon, we have the effect of relatively high normalized scores. And this speaks to, you know, Atlantic salmon having been in culture for decades. Efficiencies have been identified and optimized in the production. Therefore, on a per metric ton basis, Atlantic salmon scores reasonably well. However, from a cumulative basis, because the scale of production is so large, the score drops precipitously for both countries when we look at the cumulative impact.
Dr. Volpe says some salmon farming is now scoring quite well. For example, the Chinook salmon program in New Zealand. And he says that Atlantic salmon production is already peaking out, while the farming of other species in other countries is expanding rapidly.
Relative to the rest of the world, salmon, it obviously has its problems, and well documented they are. However, compared to the situation and the profile of production in species, other species in other parts of the world, salmon is deserves to be seen in a slightly more nuanced light than perhaps it's seen in some circles right now. And this is a wake up call that we need to start addressing these other species in other regions of the world, because the situation is looking pretty bleak.
The GAPI scores for Asian countries reflect this. China, Taiwan, and even Japan score quite low, and fish farming in those countries is growing rapidly.
The worst performing sectors of the industry are also the fastest growing, which speaks to where are we going to be 10 years from now, and what is the footprint of this industry going to be on the marine environment then.
The program looked at 20 different species, only fish that are raised in salt water. Volpe says fish farms are now taking up tens of thousands of square kilometers of the oceans, and many of the programs are far more energy intensive than land agriculture. A link to the research is at our website, aprn.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, NA. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Dental disease is a serious health problem among Alaska Natives. A recent evaluation of about 400 Alaska Native people found untreated tooth decay in more than half the children, 60% of the teenagers, and 77% of adults. Among American Indian and Alaska Native 2 to 4-year-olds, tooth decay is 5 times the national average. However, as KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, tribes are developing a program that may help fill the unmet need.
After a 2.5-year-long study, Research Institute RTI International says the Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapist Program is on course. The Kellogg and Rasmussen Foundations had asked the Institute to evaluate the program to see if it's working as planned. That's according to Rasmussen Program Officer Christopher Perez.
We have been funding the training program for quite a few years and thought it was appropriate at this time to have an evaluation of the type of care that they provide.
Principal Investigator Dr. Scott F. Wetterhall says researchers looked at how 5 therapists handled equipment, kept charts, and performed in the clinic. The researchers reviewed the therapists' work on some 300 patients. They compared fillings and reconstructions to those done by dentists and didn't find significant differences. Wetterhall says overall, the program is working.
The dental therapists are performing adequately in their technical performance. They're staying within their scope of practice. And most of the residents of the villages where these therapists work are quite proud of the therapists and pleased with the the work that they're doing.
The American Dental Association has tried to stop the therapists from practicing, saying therapists would not recognize serious problems that dentists are trained to catch and that therapists could endanger their patients. The therapists get more than 2 years of classwork, training, and practice, then work under the supervision of dentists. Perez says the report shows the therapists are performing within the scope of their training and certification. The ADA has questioned the validity of the evaluation, saying the sample size was small and shouldn't be used to guide major public health decisions. However, Wetterhall says the sample size was appropriate for his task.
And we basically feel that the 300-plus patients was an adequate, fully adequate number of patients to address the questions that we were tasked with addressing. And again, these include patient satisfaction, clinical technical performance, characteristics of the practice setting, and implementation of community-based preventive programs.
The dental therapist program is modeled after the Community Health Aid program, which was set up in the 1960s to provide basic and emergency health services in remote villages. Perez says the therapists treat cavities and help relieve pain for people who otherwise would not be able to see a dentist. Not only are people in rural Alaska happy to be getting dental health care, Perez says they're proud that the dental health aid therapists are Alaska Native.
And they were serving Native communities, and they were well respected in those communities. They had cultural skills and language fluency needed to work appropriately with their patients.
The Dental Health Aid Therapist Program is funded by the Indian Health Service and the Bethel Community Services Foundation, as well as the Kellogg and Rasmussen Foundations. It's run by tribal health organizations. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A family of bears is making a mess out of cabins near the southeast Alaska town of Pelican. A sow and two cubs have broken into about a half dozen homes in the past 5 or 6 days. Harbormaster Dave Duffy is one of the affected homeowners in the Sunnyside neighborhood, about 2 miles north of town. He says the homes are not strongly built, so they're easy for the bears to get into. He's beefed up his entryways to prevent a repeat visit.
I've got 2x4s and 2x8s bracing up my doors. I've got plywood over windows and doors. It's kind of limited my access to my own buildings. Right now I'm going through a window to get out in and out of my house.
The village public safety officer says he's talking to state troopers and wildlife officials who will decide what action to take. Duffy says residents are also discussing what to do. A trooper who happened to be passing through looked at some of the damage, but so far no action has been taken.
Well, they're kind of talking about going after it themselves, but you know, there are legalities too. We talked to somebody who has a tag, and maybe he'll show up.
He says the area is quiet since many of the homes are unoccupied this time of year. He also says it's nerve-wracking knowing the sow and cubs connect people with food.
It's dark when I come in the morning, getting darker when I go home at night. So, you know, I don't think she's been aggressive towards people, but, you know, she's destroyed all these houses. So it's just a nightly thing. I make a lot of noise going through the woods.
Pelican is about 80 miles north of Sitka and about 70 miles west of Juneau. The Chichagof Island town has about 120 residents. The company hoping to build a hydroelectric power plant on the mainland north of Petersburg has updated its plans for the development. Officials with Cascade Creek say they are reducing the potential impacts of the project by choosing an underwater power line in Thomas Bay. The company also says it plans to reduce the hydro plant's impact on Swan Lake, the high mountain lake that will be used for generating power. From Petersburg, KFSK's Joe Viknicki reports.
Cascade Creek LLC hopes to build the 70-megawatt power plant near the creek with that same name in Thomas Bay, about 15 miles northeast of Petersburg. Originally, the company had proposed two alternatives for the transmission line in the bay itself and across Frederick Sound to Petersburg. A new scoping document issued this fall by the company eliminates the alternative that includes new road and overland power lines along a portion of the Thomas Bay shoreline. Chris Spenz is the company's licensing manager.
The land-based access and transmission alternative would include 1.5 miles of new road, a portion of which would go through old growth, and the reconditioning or rebuild of an additional 3 miles approximately of road, a couple of new bridges, and just rapidly became too much potential influence on the landscape when there was a better viable alternative.
Instead, the company plans to bury the power line under the seafloor, running it across Thomas Bay to an existing U.S. Forest Service dock. From there, it would run overland along existing logging roads before crossing Frederick Sound with another submarine cable to Mitkoff Island. Another change in the latest scoping document is the company's plans for Swan Lake, the water body at just above 1,500 feet, which will provide the water for the hydro plant. Spenz says the company proposes to keep the lake at its historic monthly levels.
The whole desire and reason to maintain natural elevations at the moment is that's what's been working, and that seems to be an integral part of sustaining the existing in-lake rainbow trout population. So that's what we want to do, is keep it as it has been pre-development.
The company plans to build what it's calling an outlet control structure at the outlet of the lake, allowing it to keep the lake level at the existing maximum. Instead of water spilling out of Swan Lake at that outlet, it would be siphoned into a tunnel and buried pipe and dropped down to the powerhouse at sea level. Some residents in the area have opposed the development because of its potential impact on the popular recreational hunting and fishing spot. Also, charter and cruise companies have voiced concerns over changes to a relatively undeveloped tourism destination. Rob Cadmus, a conservation director with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, says the biggest issue with the proposed hydro plant has not changed, that the energy from the project will be exported. He says communities in the region still running on diesel power should be connected to hydropower before electricity is sent out of Southeast.
Cascade Creek is still a really important recreation area, and that combined with the fact that the energy is for export, you know, I think there's still a real question of whether or not this project is appropriate.
Meanwhile, the company is concluding its field studies at Swan Lake for this year and working to complete a preliminary draft environmental assessment document. Cascade Creek hopes to have its license application and environmental assessment turned into a FERC by the end of January. That's when the company's 3-year preliminary federal permit to study the site expires. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grantmakers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications available at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is December 1st, 2010. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.